Hello and a warm welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. This week, I'm pleased to welcome Professor Lin Lu, CEO of the Global Center for Maritime Decarbonization, or GCMD. We're here to discuss the results of two landmark pilots, one on ammonia bunkering and the other on end-to-end carbon capture that were completed recently. But I also want to look at the big picture and see how the pilots and trials led by the GCMD can trigger wider change in the maritime sector, and also what their experience reveals about how the industry can take risks and collaborate on decarbonization. So welcome to the podcast, Professor Lu.
Thanks for having me, Ariane.
One of your projects that made global headlines recently is the first ship-to-ship transfer of ammonia, which aimed to accelerate the development of ammonia bunkering. Why is ammonia bunkering an avenue that you decided to focus on in the first place? And on what timeline do you see it become part of the fuel mix for shipping?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I should mention at the outset that GCMD is technology agnostic. Our mission is really to help international shipping accelerate decarbonization. So to the extent that solutions apply, we're going to look at all the solutions. With respect to ammonia, ammonia is a new use case as a marine fuel. It's never been used as a marine fuel before. So there are lots of knowledge gaps, operational gaps. And so we figured we could value add by focusing on ammonia. Of all the other fuels, they've been demonstrated as fuels. So we can take methanol, for example. The first use of methanol as a bunker fuel was the Stena Germanica, actually a decade ago. And liquefied natural gas, of course, you know, it was in the 1960s where a purpose-built methane princess first used LNG for propulsion. So in that respect, ammonia is very, very new, and there are lots of operational and safety gaps that we thought we could value add and help close so that we can accelerate its adoption in the maritime sector.
Going back to those bunkering guidelines, typically they take years to be developed and they're usually drawn from practical operational experience. But what's interesting is that in this case, it's the other way around because guidelines have to precede commercial operations. And we know how toxic ammonia is. So my question to you would be, how can we strike the right balance between, on the one hand, accelerating the development of guidelines to make ammonia bunkering possible, and on the other hand, making sure that people and ships are 100% safe?
Yeah, so Ariane, maybe I can correct a little bit what you just said. So the guidelines, you're right, the guidelines typically have come after operations. So I'm thinking about liquefied natural gas, for example. So it's with learning, it's with doing, and then by doing, you can figure out what the guidelines should be, and then industrial guidelines came. And so there are trials that preceded the guidelines, right? And operations that preceded the guidelines. In this case, we're strong proponents that guidelines need to be in place before commercial bunkering happens, precisely because of what you said. The toxicity of ammonia is something that we need to pay specific attention to. So to the extent that we can do these pilots and learn from these pilots what those guidelines should look like, we believe that this is a way we can help accelerate adoption because we can build ecosystem confidence with guidelines in place for the crew to use ammonia, for ship owners to think about ordering vessels that use ammonia for propulsion.
Now, if we look at the practical learnings that you alluded to just now, what lessons did the pilot reveal about the main challenges to develop ammonia bunkering in more ports around the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've learned a lot from the pilot. And the pilot is because ammonia propulsion vessels aren't available today. So the pilot involved transferring ammonia between two gas carriers, right? And we tried to do this as close to bunkering conditions as possible, including transferring meaningful quantities, so 4,000 cubic meters equivalent to 2,700 tons at bunkering relevant flow rates of 700 to 800 cubes per hour. So what are the learnings? Well, one, you know, initially we thought, you know, when you do it in one of these port waters, that it could be extended to ports elsewhere. We've learned since that Met Ocean data is very important, and the local sort of current conditions, weather patterns, all are very, very important, and they dictate the thresholds with which one should think about the safety zone, the clearances that one needs for doing a transfer safely. So that's on sort of the environmental side. The other is, you know, we need a lot of coordination between the different regulatory agencies, the port authorities, so that everybody's in sync and everybody's comfortable with the idea that we're going to use ammonia as a marine fuel and we're going to transfer large volumes of ammonia. From a technical and an operational perspective, in our pilot, what we try to do is to straddle the fence between what's practical and what's safe. So we took a risk-based approach instead of having, you know, the crew all donning on respirators and very heavy-duty chemical suits. They were wearing things that would be appropriate for bunkering because you'd be in the hot sun, et cetera, et cetera. And then we would have these respirators on the side for standby in case they need it. So safety perspective, what are the safety precautions? And then we also develop emergency response plans in the event a spill happened, right? And so that was, so it's important to kind of have all these things in place. And by having these things in place, we could test them. We could test the concentrations, the thresholds, et cetera, to see whether they're meaningful and to see them be subsequently incorporated into guidelines and standards.
What has the pilot revealed about how different bunkering ammonia would be compared to bunkering methanol or LNG or conventional fuels, for example, and how realistic that could be as a bunkering operation in ports?
Yeah, so I mean, these are all different molecules with different physical and chemical properties, so they are different. For starters, methanol is a liquid, much easier to deal with at room temperature than ammonia. Ammonia has a boiling temperature of negative 33 degrees, and so it wants to be a gas, and we're transferring it as a liquid, right? So in the event of a leak or a spill, it's going to gasify or vaporize. And so it's that plume that one worries about. So how do you deal with that plume? And then at the end of the day, when you're done transferring, you have residual ammonia in the hoses. How do you get rid of that residual ammonia without exposing it and then putting it into the environment? I think ammonia today is transferred onto vessels as a cargo. And so we can learn from those procedures and what's being done on those procedures and to make it safer for when this crew is doing bunkering and transferring for into as a bunker fuel. So there are, I think, there are differences, but that's not to say that we're starting from scratch. We can borrow from our experiences dealing with liquefied natural gas because that also is a gaseous, although that one's flammable and ammonia is more toxic than flammable. We can borrow the learnings from transferring ammonia as a cargo at the terminals and how ammonia is handled on land. And we can start from there and then build in other necessary precautions simply because we're on vessels to make transferring of ammonia safe.
I understand that the aim of this kind of trials and pilots is for the industry to be able to take the learnings and deploy it on a wider scale. Where do you see that ammonia bunkering happening first in the world?
I don't have the crystal ball. We think the front runners for ammonia bunkering are likely going to be the bulk carriers. The iron ore corridor specifically is super exciting to us for a number of reasons. So I'm specifically referring to the iron ore route between Western Australia and Northern Asia. Western Australia is the largest exporter of iron ore. So these big Newcastle Max vessels come and pick up iron ore, and then they take them to Northern Asia, China, Japan, Korea. Now, if you look at where ammonia production is, Western Australia already is responsible for 5% of global tradable ammonia. So there's ammonia that's coincident with having a large volume of iron ore being exported there. So we think these are places where there could potentially be front runners with ship owners who want to trial and use ammonia as a bunker because, you know, you have the cargo and ammonia in the same place. And these vessels frequently go from point to point. I think container shipping has typically been front runners when it comes to adopting decarbonization solutions. We think it's less likely for container shipping to be front runners with ammonia, simply because container shipping go to very, very busy ports that are frequently in big cities. They like to do simultaneous operations, so loading and unloading of containers while doing everything else, including bunkering. And so eventually that may be what will happen with ammonia. Certainly that's not where we would start because there will be lots of operators. There will be lots of safety receptacles around that one needs to take into consideration. So the risk profile for bunkering container vessels would look quite different from the risk profile of bunkering, say, one of these bulk carriers along the iron ore route.
Now, I want to talk about another of your pilots, which focused on onboard carbon capture. What's interesting about it is that it went beyond what happens on the ships themselves by looking at what happens to the captured CO2 after it's offloaded. So what has the pilot revealed about the potential of developing so-called end-to-end CCS value chains? Is there a real market for this captured CO2, and can the whole thing be economically viable?
Sure. That you've asked lots of questions, and they're all very, very important. So we'll try to get to all of them, right? So maybe I can back up and tell you a little more about the pilot. So you're right, it went beyond capturing onboard vessels. So we've looked at several solutions, and there are solutions out there of onboard carbon capture technologies. And the trials have entailed capturing, evaluating how effective this capture technology is. But frequently, one is then stuck with that CO2. What do you do with that CO2? So we thought it would be important for us to try and address the fate of that CO2 that's been captured. So we focus on the downstream side of things. What happens after it's been captured? How do you offload it? And then once you've offloaded, what do you do with that CO2? So that's what the Project Captured was all about. So this entailed a evergreen container vessel that already had a Qiyao onboard carbon capture system installed. And in fact, they've done trials previously. Here, what was different was that in this particular trial, the offloading of that liquefied CO2 was done in a ship-to-ship configuration, which our study had shown that this is the most scalable configuration for offloading CO2 at scale, basically. So it was done from a ship-to-ship into a gas carrier, into a dredging gas carrier. And then that dredging gas carrier then took it to a private jetty and offloaded that CO2. And so we basically offloaded 25 tons, small scale, to demonstrate the value chain, onto a truck. And this truck then took it to Inner Mongolia to a calcium carbonate production facility and used it as a feedstock to make calcium carbonate. So we think this is really exciting because we've demonstrated for the first time that you can go from end to end, that there is an end use of the CO2. Now, we weren't so much focused on the market. We were more focused on unlocking that different pieces of the value chain to demonstrate what's possible. It probably is not the most ideal case. In fact, you know, the truck took the CO2 2,200 kilometers. And of course, this transport incurred a carbon footprint as well. Ideally, you'd like it to be as short as possible so that you can minimize carbon footprint from the transport piece. So I think in that sense, what we're excited about is that this is the first step. It's demonstrated that you can actually use the captured CO2 as a feedstock for fixing CO2. So net-net, you're doing benefit to the environment. And so we're going to come back and do life cycle assessment to look at that CO2 to see what the emissions abatement looks like. And then we'll come back and do subsequent trials to add on to it so that we can unlock and fill these different gaps one at a time.
You said there's more trials coming up. What are they going to consist of exactly? What is next? What are you going to try to demonstrate as part of those end-to-end value chain development?
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of things that we've uncovered here from a technical perspective that we'd like to address with this pilot, including, you know, the use, the tanks that were used. So in this case, because we were only offloading a small amount of CO2, but the tanks were actually quite large. And so it's not ideal because of this capacity and volume mismatch. And as a consequence, a lot of that CO2 had actually vaporized within that tank. It's not it has an escape, but it's contained within that tank. But because it's vapor, and instead of being liquid, you can't retrieve all of it for use as feedstock. So, I mean, so there are sort of these kinds of technical challenges that we'd like to come back and address, including looking at the life cycle of that CO2 and figuring out where the quote-unquote leaks are or losses are along the value chain, and see whether we can come back and do this better. One of the challenges that we had overcome in this particular pilot is the designation or the classification of the CO2. So when you capture CO2, it's by default labeled as a hazardous waste. When it's labeled as a hazardous waste, you can't use it as a feedstock to make anything else. That's the end. You kind of have to dispose of it. So one of the, I think, the challenges that we'd overcome for this particular pilot is the reclassification from hazardous waste to hazardous cargo, which enable it to be used as a feedstock for making low carbon calcium carbonate. So it's these kinds of things, both on the regulatory side, on the offloading side, on the technical side, that one needs to look at. Less on the safety, because CO2 doesn't pose safety hazard. Of course, if it displaces the oxygen, one can suffocate from not having oxygen, but it's not toxic like ammonia is.
Another aspect of that project that's quite interesting is how maritime stakeholders had to collaborate with people outside the industry. So I just wondered, what did that project reveal about the potential and maybe the challenges of collaborating and working with other industries to support shipping decarbonization?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, shipping is not a standalone industry. In fact, it's integral. It's an integral part of the global trade. It's an integral part of the global supply chain. So in order to decarbonize shipping, we depend on others, but others also depend on us, right? You wouldn't have green products if shipping wasn't green. So I think we need to find like-minded partners. We need to be mission aligned, and we form a coalition of the willing to work on this together. You mentioned a couple times, Ariane, about taking risk. I think this is the energy transition requires everybody to take risk. So the question is whether we can assign the risk appropriately to the stakeholder or the organization that can best take it, because there are different kinds of risk. There are financial risk, right? There are operational risk. In this case, Green Ore, the producer of calcium carbonate, had to take CO2 that was once a waste product, whereas they were using CO2 from somewhere else. And so that was the kind of risk they had to take. And so what we tried to do is basically to test the CO2 along the way to provide assurance that that CO2 is sufficiently pure that they could use it as a feedstock. So to the extent that we can come in and sort of mitigate these risks, we try to do so. And so it requires forming a coalition of the willing who understand the mission, who are mission aligned, who are convicted to the end cause and willing to take a little bit of risk and step outside their comfort zone.
You talk about risk, and that brings me quite nicely to your latest global maritime decarbonization survey, which showed that 60% of ship owners and operators now have net zero targets, and the use of biofuels has more than doubled compared to 2 years ago. But the report also showed that the uptake of more emerging technologies like ammonia or wind propulsion remains somehow limited. So what do you see today as the number one obstacle to achieving maritime decarbonization and getting more companies to take risk and adopt that kind of technologies?
Yeah, I mean, I think shipping as an industry is quite heterogeneous, right? I mean, you've got different ship types. Even if you look at ship owners, there are ship owners who have hundreds of vessels. There are also ship owners who have less than 20 vessels. In fact, the global fleet comprised of 60% of the ships belong to ship owners that have less than 20 vessels in their fleet, and they too need to decarbonize. So I think the risk, it's sufficient to say the risk appetite of different ship owners are quite different, but we need to do what we can. And so I think what it means in the near term is to adopt as quickly as possible the solutions that are available today. So energy efficiency technologies, including wind propulsion, but definitely drop-in biofuels. And then to have an eye on the medium-term and the longer-term solution, it's unfair to ask everybody to say, hey, you need to order ammonia vessels today since, you know, the supply is not available, even the engines and the first vessel's not on the water yet. So I think it's really different strokes for different folks, but we need to do all that we can to move as quickly as possible. And so focusing on near-term solutions that are available today is something really important. And in that respect, what GCMD is doing is trying to provide we've done pilots to provide ecosystem confidence on the supply chain integrity of biofuels, because biofuels changes hands many times before it comes to the ship owner. So as it changes hands, there are opportunities for fraudulent activity, for mislabeling, et cetera, et cetera. So we've come and put in tracers in the biofuels to provide assurance that you know what you're buying and the quantity that you're buying. We're also testing new feedstock from animal fat and from other different kinds of feedstock to expand the availability of biofuels. And then on Project Lotus, what we're doing is we're testing biofuels long-term to evaluate how its use long-term can impact engine performance or the fuel delivery system onboard vessel. So all this, we hope, will increase user confidence, user familiarity with the fuel, and so that they can adopt this at a much faster pace.
Is this aspect of verification and building trust in new fuels, new technologies, something that you want GCMD to focus on more going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. And as an organization that's also a neutral convener, I think we are uniquely positioned to do this because we're non-commercial. So to the extent that we can do this immediately for biofuels, that's important. But we also believe that once we do this for biofuels, we can extend our learnings. Maybe the technology is slightly different because the fuel type is slightly different, but we can extend our learnings into other different kinds of fuels, whether it's green ammonia or e-methanol. There, the carbon intensity is going to be really important. And so knowing how it's produced and where it's produced, you know, whether it came across, you know, the Atlantic or the Pacific to come to you is going to incur different carbon footprint. And so the carbon intensity of the fuel is different. So being able to say and assign what that carbon intensity is and account for that carbon intensity accurately becomes really important. So that's all part of this, you know, being able to build out tracing of the different fuels.
And how do you see GCMD's role going forward as the industry starts to integrate more fuels, more technologies? I mean, you can't possibly do everything. So what kind of projects, what kind of fuels, what kind of technologies do you want to prioritize?
I think given the IMO framework that was just recently approved, and we're reasonably optimistic that it will be adopted in October, we're focused on the near-term solutions. We think it's really important to accelerate adoption of biofuels, accelerate the adoption of energy efficiency technologies. So there, the bottleneck is really overcoming the fuel savings uncertainty. So already we've sensorized several vessels so that we can measure with additional confidence the fuel savings. And then to basically partner and complement that is to develop a blended financing scheme with banks and investors so that we can deploy what we call pay-as-you-save as a mechanism where ship owners can take out loan, and the payback on the loan is pegged to the performance or the fuel savings of the technology. So in this way, you can share the risk and share the reward amongst all the stakeholders involved. We think if we can build up user confidence again in the fuel savings, and we can get the banks comfortable with a slightly different financing scheme where everybody benefits, we think this can really accelerate the adoption of these different technologies. So that's important in the near term. But again, we're not sort of taking our foot off the accelerator on looking at ammonia and carbon capture, because those are equally important. And in order to decarbonize shipping, we believe we need a portfolio of solutions. So we kind of need to do everything. So to the extent that there are gaps and we see ourselves value adding to close these gaps, we'll be there.
On what aspect do you think GCMD can make the biggest difference? Is it on the technical aspect, on the finance side, or on the regulation, or a bit of all of those?
Where GCMD can make a difference is we're uniquely positioned to take some of these risks. And so we can do the first of a kind of X or Y or Z, as long as we can identify what the gap is and what's needed. And when we do that, we can show the world what's possible. When we show the world what's possible, hopefully others will come in and do more. And it's through this incremental learning that the entire ecosystem will get there. So just to give you an example, we'll come back to the ammonia pilot. Before we did the ammonia pilot in the Pilbara, there was very little ammonia was exported from Port Dampier, but that was it, right? And so Pilbara Ports recently finished their strategy development, their roadmap for decarbonization, and ammonia is now featured prominently in there. I would like to think, in no small part because we had done this pilot, to show that it is possible to do ammonia bunkering in that region. Rotterdam, 2 months ago, had conducted an ammonia transfer pilot, not very different from what we had done, but in their environment. So it takes that local constraints into consideration, but it's again a ship-to-ship transfer of ammonia, leveraging the learnings from our pilot. So I think it's through this incremental, progress is always incremental. It's doing more and learning more together and sharing more together that we can move the entire ecosystem.
And to finish, are you optimistic that the shipping industry can and will reach net zero by 2050?
I am a pragmatic optimist. I believe shipping will reach net zero. The timeline is challenging. So what we need to do, and I know I sound like a broken record at this point, is to move as quickly as possible.
Professor Liu, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.